And I would really want to suggest that what happened at the U.S. Capitol last week on January 6th is not actually a protest. It's not a part of popular demand of the people to right the wrongs of society. It's
when a Christian church exists that doesn't want to accept anybody but white people, right? They've already denied the faith, all right? Can you be a Christian and a racist at the same time?
When I say questioning the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together. These are the triple evils that are interrelated.
Today we venerate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as we celebrate what would have been his 92nd birthday and legacy. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Today we examine the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. legacy and impact by highlighting organizations who have continued the work of the nonviolent movement, also known as the CRM, Civil Rights Movement, on the 92nd anniversary of his birth. Reflecting on Dr. King's speech, we look at the wealth gap in America, a lack of access to basic health care in the midst of one of the worst pandemics in modern times, and systematic racism that impacts the quality of life for African Americans and other people of color. Dr. Imtiazi Sanyika stated that Dr. King's 1967 speech, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, and book, offers a significant structural critique of the American political economy with its suffocating poverty and its deep inequalities despite the material abundance and technological advances. Dr. King had been criticized by the youthful advocates of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, who contended that power was the primary prerequisite for any further progress after the 1964 and 1965 civil rights legislation. Dr. King's Chaos or Community was presented at the 11th Annual Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC Convention, in Atlanta, Georgia, August 16, 1967.
I want to say to you, as I move to my conclusion, as we talk about where do we go from here, we must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here. One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. And you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? These are words that must be said. Now, don't think you have me in a bind today. I'm not talking about communism. What I'm talking about is far beyond communism. My inspiration didn't come from Karl Marx. My inspiration didn't come from Ingalls. My inspiration didn't come from Trotsky. My inspiration didn't come from Lenin. Yes, I read Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital a long time ago. And I saw that maybe Marx didn't follow Hegel enough. He took his dialectics, but he left out his idealism and his spiritualism, and he went over to a German philosopher by the name of Feuerbach and took his materialism and made it into a system that he called dialectical materialism. I have to reject that. What I'm saying to you this morning, communism forgets that life is individual. Capitalism forgets that life is social. And the kingdom of brotherhood is found neither in the thesis of communism nor the antithesis of capitalism, but in a higher synthesis. It's found in a higher synthesis that combines the truths of both. Now, when I say questioning the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together. These are the triple evils that are interrelated. So I conclude by saying today, and we have a task, and let us go out with a divine dissatisfaction. Let us be dissatisfied until America will no longer have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history and every family will live in a decent sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of that character, not on the basis of the color of that skin. Let us be dissatisfied. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy, and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied until from every city hall justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when the lion and the lamb shall lie down together. And every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. Let us be dissatisfied. Men will recognize that out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when nobody will shout white power, when nobody will shout black power, but everybody will talk about God's power and human power.
Thanks to Dr. Imtiazgalezi Sanyika. Outside the historic Brown Chapel AME Church in Selma, Alabama, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Spoke with civil rights pioneer, the late Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian, a close friend and lieutenant to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Dr. Vivian is the founder of the C.T. Vivian Leadership Institute, former national director of affiliates of SCLC, and on the boards of the Center for Democratic Renewal and the National Voting Rights Museum.
Nonviolent direct action is something we have brought to America, right? Nonviolent direct action has no violence in it. It is not there to destroy. It's there to develop and build. And that's what we've been trying to do. At the core of that is an understanding of faithful life, all right?
Do you think full voting rights have been achieved at this point?
No. Because America won't change that quickly. Or if they had, they would have done it in 1776. There is nothing we haven't done for this nation. We've died for it, huh? It's been overlooked what we've done for it. But knowing the scriptures, we kept living by faith. We kept understanding that it's something deeper than politics that makes life worth living.
What gave you the courage 50 years ago to stand up at the courthouse to make that walk?
Faith. Mm-hmm. Huh? Our grandmothers and great-grandmothers taught us how to live, right? Even when they couldn't speak well as long as what the society was concerned about. But they were telling us about is as old as the universe itself.
Can you describe what happened to you, the violence against you, even leading up to March 7th, when you stood up for voting rights?
It's the understanding of nonviolent direct action. That's the change. What we have to see beyond all things, that Martin King was our leader. What we have and what was given to us from its very beginnings is an understanding that we could not win by killing. Light doesn't come because of darkness, all right? We are here to change America and always have been. America sees it as they're changing us. Mm-hmm. But you see, when a Christian church exists that doesn't want to accept anybody but white people, right? They've already denied the faith, all right? Can you be a Christian and a racist at the same time? And we refuse to be racist, mm-hmm. right? We just want to simply tell America what their faith is about. America talks about democracy, but they've kept us from voting for years. And even when they give us the vote on paper, politically, they turn around and take away the important part of what we have fought for and what they said they were giving. The truth is that we have to work together to save ourselves politically, save ourselves spiritually, and save ourselves physically. When the preacher has to stand at the door and keep people out because of the color of their skin, something's wrong with their faith.
Did you stand in front of Sheriff Clark and get punched in the face?
Well, yes, but that's not why I was standing there. Point being is I was standing in front of him because we don't have to fear the opposition, and we are willing to die for the freedom they say they have.
The Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian. Dr. Ann Lundy, music director of the Community Music Center of Houston, whose mission for over four decades has been the preservation, appreciation, and performance of music that reflect Black musical traditions. The Community Music Center of Houston will present a live 40th anniversary musical commemoration of Dr. King's love of Black music.
I'm Ann Lundy, music director of the Community Music Center of Houston. We've been having a musical tribute to Martin Luther King for almost 40 years. This is our way as musicians to recognize and remember his many contributions to the world. I would see these wonderful marches and the rallies and those wonderful things in our community and on television. And I thought to myself, our way of letting the world know that he touched everybody's lives. But as a musician, as someone who lives and works in the arts, he also inspired us. And through his inspiration, we just feel like this is our way of remembering him with our musical offerings. I knew about Coretta Scott King, that she was a trained musician. My understanding that she was a wonderful musical artist, I think that contributed to the family's love with music. I remember one of those famous speeches when he says, if I was a drum major, I was a drum major for righteousness. I was a drum major for peace. Those kinds of things where he would include musical references regarding how we as human beings can relate to each other. Everybody loves some kind of music. If you go any part of the world, there's some kind of musical offering. Music, I always thought of as the universal language. So we've been doing this for, like we said, almost 40 years. I've always wanted to involve the community in celebrating his many contributions, include the musical aspects of life. It doesn't matter what you do musically. Just enjoy music. Participate in music.
Well, speaking of participation, tell us about what we're going to hear today.
Yeah, speaking from our past musical experiences, we go to what I think of as we used to call the old Negro spirituals, one of those famous spirituals from the church, Soon I Will Be Done with the Troubles of the World, going home to live with God. The song, Glory, the combination of the orchestra playing live and the rapper and the singer, that was very exciting for us. And I'm just so glad that we got a chance to do that. And I hope to do even more of those different kinds of musical genres. And this was about the march over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day when the war is won, we will be sure. We will be sure. Oh, glory. Oh, glory. Oh, glory. Glory, yeah.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is the rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition to us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. Shots we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop and we ran up.
Oh, one day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
This was a very important part of Dr. King's life and legacy that I hope you will all remember. As musicians, this is our way of remembering Dr. King's many contributions to humanity.
How can the audience view this performance? Everything is online due to the pandemic.
Visit our website, Community Music Center of Houston. You can look us up there. Thank you so much. I'm Ann Lundy, Community Music Center of Houston, music director.
The International Commission of Inquiry on U.S. Police Violence will convene a hearing on violence against people of African descent and to hold the United States accountable before the international community on Dr. King's holiday, January the 18th through February the 6th, 2021.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg, producer of WBAI's Equal Rights and Justice and co-producer with Ken Nash of Building Bridges for COVID, Race, and Democracy, speaking with Lennox Hines internationally acclaimed criminal and human rights attorney and chair of the International Commission of Inquiry to open hearings on racist police violence scheduled to convene on MLK Day. The commission's judges hail from countries around the globe and include notable figures such as Sir Claire Roberts, former president of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, Professor Sir Hilary Beckles, UN advisor and chair of the CARICOM Reparations Commission, and pioneering lawyer with Nelson Mandela against apartheid, Hina Jilani. Hines says the commission is the latest attempt to give voice to the international outrage resulting from the public lynching of George Floyd and expose the pandemic of racist police violence against people of African descent and to hold the United States government accountable before the international community. Lennox Hines.
In June of last year, hundreds of organizations wrote to the United Nations Human Rights Council demanding that an independent investigation on systemic racism in policing be conducted in the United States. The three organizations, the Conference of Black Lawyers, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and the Lawyers Guild, launched this project. We have looked at the issue as it has been amplified over the last half a century. If you look at the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, remember that many of the cities in the United States went up in flames as a result of, and I'm just giving you the quotation from the Kerner Commission report, which was the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders. In 1968, the Kerner Commission said to some Negroes, the police have come to symbolize white power, white racism, and white oppression. And the fact is that many police do reflect and express these white attitudes. The atmosphere of hostility and cynicism is reinforced by a widespread belief among Negroes in the existence of police brutality and in a double standard of justice and protection, one for Negroes and one for whites. Even today, look at and compare how the white mob that invaded the capital of the United States, how the police dealt with them, as opposed to demonstrators who were demonstrating against real injustice at the hands of the police, how they were treated, that is the Black Lives Movement, whose outrage were triggered by the public lynching of George Floyd. The actions by state and federal law enforcement were completely different. And that is double standard that even 60 years ago was being addressed in the Kerner Commission report. So when we talk about a systemic nature of the problem, we are saying that the manifestation of the problems that we see today in 2020, the communities that have been victimized have been protesting against this double standard going back over half a century. The commissioner's mandate is very clear. They are to make a finding as to whether there exists reasonable grounds to believe that after they have heard all of the evidence and after they have looked at all of the data going back over the last 50 to 60 years of the role of the police and the atrocities that have been committed, whether a consistent pattern of systemic racism in policing and gross violations of human rights exists in the United States, carried out by officials of the United States acting under color of law, and whether or not this was directed against people of African descent. Commissioners are going to make recommendations in terms of what remedies do they see should be implemented to rectify this systemic problem. Now, they are going to look at the demands that have come out of the community, including the demands for defunding the police and so on. They are going to address what they see. These are all international human rights experts coming from various jurisdictions in terms of the application of international human rights standards. They're going to be looking at demands that have come out of the community in terms of legislative proposals to decentralize the police, to establish more community control. And there are all types of proposals that have been advanced over the years. They'll study them and they will make their recommendations.
I've been speaking with Lennox Hines. For COVID, Race, and Democracy, I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
What's wrong with the world, mama? People living like they ain't got no mamas. I think the whole world's addicted to the drama. Only attracted to things that'll bring the trauma. Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism. But we still got terrorists here living in the USA. The big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate. And to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate. And that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach and would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us, send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning, where is the love?
Change. New days are strange. Is the world insane? If love and peace are so strong, why are the pieces of love that don't belong? Nations dropping bombs. Chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering. As the youth are young, so ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of them dividends. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. What's the love, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Or where's the truth, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
Or where's the love, y'all?
People killing, people dying, children hurting, you hear them crying. When you practice what you preach, would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
Where is the love? Where is the love?
On April 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year prior to the date of his assassination, the Reverend Dr. King gave his Beyond Vietnam speech at Riverside Church in New York City. KPFK's producer Polina Vasiliev files this report.
That is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam. And I watched this program broken and eviscerated as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such.
Many historians suggest that this speech by Martin Luther King Jr. sealed his fate because of his condemnation of state violence at home and abroad.
Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Glenn Ford, executive editor and founder of the Black Agenda Report, reflects on Dr. King's anti-imperialist politics.
A year before his assassination, that he delivered that brilliant and historic speech. We have to be clear, this was an anti-imperialist position that he was taking back in 1967. This position was nothing new in Black America, even at that time. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, came out against the draft years before Dr. King's speech. And Muhammad Ali, famously in 1967, refused to be drafted. And he said that no Vietnamese never called me. They never lynched me, and they never set any dogs on me. Ever since Black people have been tracked by the polls, they have been shown to be the group that was most opposed to U.S. military adventures abroad. Broadly speaking, there is a Black position on foreign policy. And broadly speaking, we would describe that as anti-imperialists. So when Dr. King made that speech at Riverside Church in 1967, he was not just speaking for himself. He was speaking from the Black radical tradition. And that tradition is broadly based, and it is a popular tradition. However, There was a Black Miss Leadership class even then. It was a lot smaller than it is today, but it existed. And it was very eager to get in the good graces and make its political fortunes in the Democratic Party. And it was appalled that the nation's premier civil rights leader would dare to challenge the war policies of the Democratic president and of Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic vice president. So they urged Dr. King to shut up, to keep his mouth shut unless he was just going to talk about civil rights and to not challenge the Democrat in the White House.
Glenn Ford spoke to the Real News Network in April of 2016. According to a recent report from the Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs at Brown University, the U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Pakistan have cost American taxpayers $6.4 trillion since they began in 2001. For Pacifica, this is Paulina Vasilia.
Liz Theo Harris is calling for a revolution, a moral revolution, that is, for the soul of America. She is director of Karyos Center and co-chair of the People's Campaign. Needless to say, she knows her way around a protest or demonstration or two. In fact, she says she and a group of ministers were arrested while praying on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. Reverend Liz Theo Harris.
So I have been engaged in grassroots anti-poverty organizing and nonviolent direct action for about 25 years now. So it would be hard to say how many times I've protested, including at the U.S. Capitol. In 2018, the Poor People's Campaign launched with the largest and most expansive wave of nonviolent civil disobedience at the U.S. Capitol and at state capitals across the country. It was really the largest wave of nonviolent civil disobedience in U.S. history. And so I'm pretty familiar with folks, popular movements actually coming together, making our demands clear, protesting nonviolently. And I would really want to suggest that what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th is not actually a protest. It's not a part of popular demands of the people to right the wrongs of society. It really is a failed attempt, but an attempt at subverting democracy, of taking away the power of people and the power of people to elect leaders that can then be put into office to expand healthcare and raise wages and make life better for folk. And so, you know, I think what we have been met with before when protesting at the U.S. Capitol has been excessive force for just praying, for just singing, for marching peacefully. But also why we're at the Capitol is for very different reasons. It's to call those, including some of these senators and congresspeople and surely the president himself, to account for policy violence. And who was at the Capitol last week was trying to, you know, continue that kind of policy violence and violence perpetrated against people across this country.
Absolutely. And, of course, we've been calling it an insurrection and a failed coup attempt. There have been a number of arrests. The police officer that has been taking selfies with the mob, well, he's been fired. The guy in the big headpiece with the horns was wearing a QAnon shirt, and he was arrested. Some were heard giving military orders throughout the crowd, confirming suspicions that ex-militia and law enforcement were among those supporters that stormed the Capitol. Reverend Theo Harris, January 2021 has really gotten off on a historic start. This month, we witnessed the red state of Georgia turn blue, and as a result, Democrats will wield control of the White House and both houses of Congress. Juxtapose that, however, against one of the most horrific political insurgencies in modern day. And in the very same month, the first Black woman will be next in line to the presidency. And race is the dynamic fueling each of these situations. Reverend Liz Seal Harris, is America winning or losing the fight to end racism in this country?
So I think we have to see January 6th and, you know, months and years of a kind of fascistic white supremacist movement gaining strength and gaining support from Trump and from many of his enablers and other senators and congresspeople. We have to see it in light of the fact that the night before, indeed, Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock was and John Ossoff were elected as the first Black and Jewish senators of the state of Georgia in an election where there was very historic voter turnout, especially amongst poor and low-income white, Black, Latino, Native people from rural areas and urban areas and small towns. And following an election, a general election, where, again, historic numbers of what is a fusion coalition of people turning out, especially when politicians say they're interested in expanding health care and raising wages. And so I think these are not easy times. We have seen this kind of violence before, especially, actually, when progressive change around race, around poverty are happening, and that there's this response, this reaction that is very reactionary to it. You know, we saw this in the period after the Civil War, in the period of Reconstruction, where you then had these destructionists who, you know, rioted like folk did last week, who lynched and killed. We've seen it, you know, as a response to Native American, Indigenous people. We've seen it as workers and as women and as Latinos and as Asians have come together fighting for justice in our nation's history, and we're seeing it again. And so I think we've learned a lot from our brothers and sisters in South Africa, where folks have taught us the saying that a dying mule kicks the hardest. So I would like to suggest that rather than, you know, a movement for racial justice that is really strong and growing right now, on the wane, instead, we're getting this kind of reaction because of the strength, because of people needing and definitely coming together, you know, in the movement for Black lives, in the powerful organizing amongst immigrants, some of the stands that Native American Indigenous folks are, and you know, what we in the Poor People's Campaign are doing of pulling together people across race into a powerful racial and economic justice movement. And I think that's exciting.
With the latest discussion about policy violence with Reverend Liz Theo Harris of the Poor People's Campaign and the continuation of Dr. King's work for social justice at poorpeoplescampaign.org. Thanks to Verna Avery Brown of WPFW for filing this report.
Until the killing of Black men, Black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of a white man, a white mother's son. Oh, we who believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom cannot rest.
Cannot we who believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom cannot rest.
Tell you that which touches me most is that I had the chance to work with people, and I'm passing on to others that which was passed on to me. Woe to me, young people come first. They have the courage where we fail. And if I could but shed some light as they carry us through the gale. Come on now, we who believe in freedom.
We believe in freedom cannot rest.
Cannot rest, we who believe in.
Reverend Dr. Bernice King, daughter of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, spoke at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, reflecting on the impact of the civil rights movement and her father's beloved community.
As a result of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act in 1968, we have witnessed great strides toward freedom for all, regardless of race, color, gender, religion, national origin, disability, class, or sexual orientation. 50 years later, in this year of Jubilee, we're standing once again in the shadow of that great emancipator, having been summoned to these hallowed grounds to reverberate the message of that great liberator. For there's a remnant from 1963, Congressman Lewis, Ambassador Young, that still remains, who has come to bequeath that message of freedom to a new generation of people who must now carry that message in their time, in their communities, amongst their tribes, and amongst their nations of the world. We must keep the sound and the message of freedom and justice going. It was my mother, as has been said previously, Coretta Scott King, who in fact 30 years ago assembled a coalition of conscience that started us on this whole path of remembering the anniversary of the March on Washington. She reminded us that struggle is a never-ending process. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation. And so we come once again to let freedom ring, because if freedom stops ringing, then the sound will disappear and the atmosphere will be charged with something else. For today, 50 years later, my friends, we are still crippled by practices and policies steeped in racial pride, hatred, and hostility, some of which have us standing our ground rather than finding common ground. We are still chained by economic disparities, income and class inequalities, and conditions of poverty for many of God's children around this nation and the world. We're still bound by a cycle of civil unrest and inherent social biases in our nation and world that oftentimes degenerates into violence and destruction, especially against women and children. We're at this landing, and now we must break the cycle. The prophet King spoke the vision. He made it plain, and we must run with it in this generation. His prophetic vision and magnificent dream describe the yearning of people all over the world to have the freedom to prosper in life, which is the right to pursue one's aspirations, purpose, dreams, well-being, without oppressive, depressive, repressive practices, behaviors, laws, and conditions that diminish one's dignity and that denies one life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The freedom to participate in government, which is the right to have a voice and a say in how you are represented, regulated, and governed without threats of tyranny, disenfranchisement, exclusionary tactics, and behaviors. And to have freedom to peacefully coexist, which is the right to be respected in one's selfhood, individuality, and uniqueness without fear of attack, assault, or abuse. In 1967, my father asked a poignant and critical question: where do we go from here, chaos or community? And we say with a resounding voice, no to chaos and yes to community. If we're going to rid ourselves of the chaos, then we must make a necessary shift. Nothing is more tragic than for us to fail to achieve new attitudes and new mental outlooks. We have a tremendous and unprecedented opportunity to reset the very means by which we live, work, and enjoy our lives. If we're going to continue the struggle of freedom and create true community, then we will have to be relentless in exposing, confronting, and ridding ourselves of the mindset of pride and greed and selfishness and hate and lust and fear and idleness and lack of purpose and lack of love, as my brother said, for our neighbor. We must seize this moment, the dawning of a new day, the emergence of a new generation who is postured to change the world through collaborative power facilitated by unconditional love.
Reverend Dr. Bernice King.
Take a look in the mirror. Look at yourself. But don't you look too close. Cause you just might see the person that you hate the most. Just take a look at your children, born innocent. Every boy and every girl. Denying themselves a real chance to build a better world. Dear Lord, dear Lord, take a look at your children. Is hate.
The stunning victory in the Georgia senatorial race against the backdrop of unchecked violence in the halls of Congress, and a black woman is second in line to the presidency. Are we winning or losing the war against racism? Senator-elect Reverend Raphael Warnock, the first African-American senator elected to the state of Georgia and the senior pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the spiritual home of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Sr. and Jr.
Here in the wee hours, Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, Georgia had elected its first black senator and its first Jewish senator. And then, as we were basking in the glory of all that that represented, it seemed like we could only have a few hours to celebrate. Just as we were trying to put on our celebration shoe, the ugly side of our story, our great and grand American story, began to emerge as we saw the crude and the angry and the disrespectful and the violent break their way into the people's house. Some carrying Confederate flags, signs and symbols of an old world order passing away. The old order is slipping away. Sometimes it responds violently and desperately. You cut the head off of a snake, shakes, moves violently, not because it is living, but because it is dying. There's more than one way to be violent. You don't have to bomb bullets violent. There is the violence of prejudice and fear. Your words can be violent. Violence of prejudice and fear. We saw it in Charlottesville. How we've seen it over the last 4 years. We've seen it in the current occupant of the Oval Office, who told folks to stand back and stand by. It is a kind of violence that dehumanizes all of us. And we saw it, and we saw it in the paradox between the response between those who were clearly insurrectionists. They were not protesters, they were rioters tearing up the people's house. They were handled with the kind of kid gloves with humanity. One could not help but juxtapose that to the response to those who were responding this summer to the deaths of George Floyd and the death of Breonna Taylor. Those who rose up in peaceful, nonviolent struggle. Those who were just there outside of the White House and were met with brute force so that the occupant of the White House might march down a sidewalk, stand in front of a church, and hold the Bible upside down. So there is both victory in this moment, and there is violence in this moment. There is fantastic opportunity and fierce opposition and it reminds us that there is still a whole lot of work to do.
Senator-elect Reverend Raphael Warnock, this concludes our special edition of COVID Race and Democracy. Special thanks to the Pacifica COVID Task Force and Pacifica stations and affiliates who have contributed to this production. You can find this and all previous episodes on our website, along with today's playlist, at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Today's show was produced by Fahima Sack, Lona Alliance, and Nicole Holt, and edited by Lona Alliance. Executive producers are Steve Zelter, Polina Vasiliev, and Nicole Holt. Special thanks to producers Mimi Rosenberg, Verna Avery Brown, Polina Vasiliev, and Dr. Mtangalizi Sanyika for his contribution to the show. I am Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Today's playlist includes Community Music Center of Houston's live performance of Glory and Troubles of the World, Ella's Song, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Where is the Love, Black Eyed Peas, and Aretha Franklin. Take a look.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen from the website covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.